From deep in the Swedish forest, the only individualist radio program in Europe. This is VSI Radio International. Trouble ain't what people don't know, it's what they know that ain't so. Spending at least as much time listening as I do talking, this is the voice of a sovereign individual. My name is Paul Lambert. While many people may lament the fact that summer is very short in the Nordic countries, I find it just as unfortunate that autumn is even shorter. I'm never one to complain about the weather, and I understand that each season has a purpose, but I must say that I envy those of you at more southerly latitudes who get to enjoy the colours of autumn. I envy you the large maple and oak trees in October as the leaves begin to turn. A single tree might all at once have a number of colours, as it seems that each individual leaf turns red or yellow, while the others stay green longer. It's really pretty, for instance, to go down to a lake located in the middle of a deciduous forest on a bright, crisp day and see the colours of the trees reflected on the surface of the water. It's a little bit different here. During the Nordic autumn, each tree seems to decide individually when it wants to start turning colours, some sooner than others, but then the entire tree begins to change colour in a steady and uniform manner, with all the leaves changing together in exactly the same way, from green to red to yellow, and then finally brown, before falling to the ground. So, sadly, our deciduous trees don't get to wear the autumn technicolor dream coats that the trees in more moderate climes do, but still the Nordic autumn is very beautiful in its own way. While going for my evening walk through the forest, I can see deer in the fields at a distance. I encounter a large number of frogs and toads that are out now, looking for places to hibernate, and on occasion I'll even encounter a fox or a badger. I suppose I'm rather introverted, since I can so easily be entertained merely by the surrounding environment, while most other people take it for granted. Yeah, who needs Discovery Channel? When I think of it, autumn is a great time of the year in this part of the world. It's still warm enough to spend long hours outdoors, but cool enough to have a campfire at night. And then it's finally dark enough to do some stargazing. And then again, it's a great time for radio propagation and shortwave listening. Alas, autumn is short. The leaves on the tree only begin to turn color during the first week of October, and by the end of October, they will have all fallen and the trees will be bare. Of course, you, as a shortwave listener, are likely smarter, at least more worldly and aware than the average Joe, probably by at least one standard deviation, as the statisticians might say. So you likely understand why the seasons change. I thought that was something that everyone understood by at least the fifth grade in elementary school, but I was wrong. What's more upsetting is not so much in that people I met don't know why the seasons change, but that so many of them have never even thought of it. They simply accepted the periodic changes of the seasons without even wondering why it happens. I cannot imagine being so utterly bereft of curiosity. In fact, I feel a kind of mental claustrophobia just thinking about it. Now, it can be understandable that many people might think that the seasons are due to the Earth coming closer and farther from the Sun as it travels along in its elliptical orbit. Of course, that's not true. In fact, the Earth is actually closer to the Sun in the winter, that is, the winter in the Northern Hemisphere. The Earth is closest to the Sun. It's at its perihelion on the winter solstice, or on about the 21st of December. Thus, the cooler weather and the changing of the colors of leaves is happening at a time when the planet is actually coming nearer to the Sun. For those in Australia and South Africa and the Southern Hemisphere in general, the seasons are opposite, to those experienced in the north. Thus, as we in North America and Europe are approaching winter, the Australians are approaching summer. That too is widely known, but many of the people I've met who harbored the misconception that seasons are due to the Earth moving closer and farther will at the same time be fully aware of the seasons in the two hemispheres being opposite. So just what are they thinking? What strikes me in this matter is not the misconception itself, but the lack of lateral thinking and consistent understanding. If indeed seasons were due to the Earth moving closer or farther from the Sun, then the seasons should be the same all over the Earth. Yet these people know and have long known that such is not the case, while still long having believed that the seasons are due to the Earth's changing proximity to the Sun. It's a bit flabbergasting, actually. I cannot begin to try to understand such a phenomenon. Is it a mild form of what George Orwell identified as doublethink? The capacity of being able simultaneously to hold two conflicting concepts and not experiencing any sort of cognitive dissonance? Or is it just simply a case of intellectual laziness, an unwillingness or disinclination even to consider one's own conceptions in relation to one another? Well, as it's understood today, the change of season is due to the Earth being tilted, its axis being about 23.5 degrees off the perpendicular of the plane of the Earth's orbit around the Sun. At the winter solstice, or the first day of winter in the Northern Hemisphere, the Earth at the North Pole is tilted 23.5 degrees directly away from the Sun. Thus, the Northern Hemisphere receives far less light, is cooler, and experiences winter. At that same moment, the Southern Hemisphere receives more light, is warmer, and experiences summer. Of course, 6 months later, the situation is the opposite, with more sunlight shining on the Northern Hemisphere and less on the Southern Hemisphere, and thus the seasons are reversed. The 23.5 degree tilt of the Earth's axis relative to the plane of its orbit around the Sun also accounts for the phenomena of the Arctic and Antarctic circles. At 66.5 degrees north and south, respectively, the polar circles are 23 degrees in latitude away from the north and south poles. In the north, at winter solstice, this 23.5 degree tilt means that the region within the Arctic Circle is completely turned away from the sun and thus experiences darkness around the clock. Conversely, at the summer solstice, the entire region within the Arctic Circle completely faces the sun, and thus those within it experience round-the-clock daylight. I did experience the midnight sun once when I lived in Iceland. The city of Reykjavik is at 64 degrees north, so in the summer it was daylight around the clock, as the sky was always light. However, the sun itself did go down below the horizon. However, on the 21st of June, 1996, I traveled north to a town called Husavik, located on the northern coast. The northernmost point of Iceland is located almost exactly on the Arctic Circle. At Husavik, on the summer solstice, you can stand on the shoreline and look directly north at local midnight to see the disk of the sun sink over the ocean until the bottom of the sun just touches the surface of the water and illuminates the sea in a beautifully hazy orange color. It lasts only a few minutes, and then the sun begins to rise again into the sky. It's quite an amazing experience, really. Now, moreover, the tilt of the Earth accounts for the region known as the tropics. 23.5 degrees north and 23.5 degrees south mark the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn, respectively. It is in this region, and only in this region, that the sun is ever directly overhead to an observer on Earth. From the vantage point of an earthbound observer, the sun reaches its northernmost point in the sky on the summer solstice, on or about the 21st of June, which is traditionally the first day in which the sun enters the constellation of Cancer, hence the name Tropic of Cancer. At the spring and autumn equinoxes, the sun is directly over the equator, while at winter solstice, the sun is at the southernmost point in the sky, as it traditionally entered into the constellation of Capricorn, before heading northward again, making the days once more become longer and longer in the northern hemisphere, and shorter in the southern, as the sun continues to travel along its apparent path in the sky, called the ecliptic, which in actuality is the Earth's path of travel around the sun, but in the opposite direction. Of course, we on Earth experience the heavenly bodies as traveling around us, and the constellations through which the sun passes as it travels along the ecliptic are those that form the zodiac. Now, I said that the summer solstice takes place at a time that was traditionally the first day of Cancer, and the winter solstice at a time that was traditionally the first day of Capricorn, because at present, the sun does not actually appear to be in those constellations at those times. The entire zodiac has shifted one constellation, or one sign, backward since those observations were first made in antiquity. In fact, anyone celebrating a birthday today, the 9th of October, is said to be a Libra. However, at present, the sun is currently in Virgo. This slow shifting is due to a slight wobbling of the Earth's axis. While the axis is more or less constant at 23.5 degrees, the direction in which it is pointing slowly shifts over a 26,000-year cycle, thus throwing off the apparent directions of the stars as we observe them in a phenomenon known as precession. Now I say that 23.5 degrees is more or less constant because in addition to precession, the axis of the Earth also nods back and forth very slightly but measurably in a phenomenon known as nutation. That's nutation with an N as in November. Not to be confused with mutation, with an M as in Mike. As opposed to solstices in summer and winter, the first days of spring and autumn are marked by what are called equinoxes. From the vantage point of an observer on Earth, this is when the sun is directly over the equator. While in terms of the Earth traveling around the sun, an equinox is the moment that the Earth's axis is parallel to its orbital path. Now, serious astronomers are very picky and technical about that point. They insist that it is not, as the name otherwise implies, the time when night and day are equal all over the Earth. Of course, the word equinox suggests that very thing. Equi is a prefix from Latin meaning even or same, while the Latin word nox in the nominative or noctis in the genitive means night, from which we get words like nocturnal. So in fairness to all those involved, let's just say that an equinox is the moment that the Earth's axis is parallel to its orbit around the sun. As a result, day and night are equally long at all points in the world at that time. Keep in mind that at every given moment, no matter what time of year it is, exactly half the world experiences day and exactly half experiences night. The question is, how much daylight is experienced at any given point on the Earth, and that will change with the passing of the seasons. As we said, the Earth is tilted 23.5 degrees. This results in the North Pole pointing toward an apparently fixed star in the northern sky known as Polaris, the North Star. This leads me to an even more common misconception that is widely held and has sadly made its way into popular culture. You know, perhaps it's a bit of a psychological hang-up I suffer and take too seriously, but I find that I cannot appreciate stories, songs, jokes, poetry, or really anything else that contains factual errors. Now, I don't mean in cases of science fiction or fantasy or alternative history where one must necessarily suspend his disbelief in cases where the given scenario is clearly make-believe, but in cases where little mistaken facts creep in, be they anachronisms or other simple mistakes in fact that could easily have been checked. I'll give you an example, actually two examples in one, as you'll understand. Some weeks ago, I heard on the radio a clip played from a science fiction film. I don't remember the film, and I really don't remember what was going on in the clip. What I do remember was the sloppy misconception regarding the British monarchy and its succession. A misconception that is widespread and which is now even more widespread thanks to mainstream media. What's worse, this particular slip-up was not at all important to the overall plot of the story, but thanks to the slip-up, I forgot nearly everything else in that film. Well, this is what happened. The story is about a time traveller from the past, from England, who travels to some time in the rather proximate future, at a time when the current Prince Charles has ascended to the throne and has become king. The time traveller meets a woman from the time in which the story is taking place and asks her who the king is. She says, King Charles. King Charles. Now, those of us outside the British realm might be forgiven this misconception, but those writing film scripts inside or outside the British realm are certainly not. What's worse, all sorts of people, even in England, and in places like Australia and Canada, New Zealand, and other places where people should know better, they're under the impression that the current Prince Charles will one day become King Charles. And that's simply not the case, at least as it stands now. The reigning Queen Elizabeth indeed once was Princess Elizabeth. However, when it comes to kings on the British throne, as a rule, they take a new name as king and do not keep the names they had as princes. The former monarch, the late King George VI, was known, until his coronation, as Prince Albert. He did not become King Albert. Now, certainly there have been kings named Charles, but that name has become associated with a certain degree of notoriety, and thus Prince Charles will likely take another name upon ascending to the throne. And in fact, as an actual beefeater at the Tower of London once told me, Prince Charles will most likely become King George VII. Will he have a sudden change of heart and pick another name, or even remain Charles? It's not impossible, but given the long tradition of kings changing their names, and the fact that the matter in Prince Charles' case seems long to have been decided without any further discussion, it is sloppy of the screenwriter simply to presume that the next monarch will be King Charles and not even do any checking. And that brings me to the next related but much more important misconception. This summer, a future king was born. Prince William and his wife Kate had a boy. For several days they waited before announcing what his name would be, but in the end, the world got to find out that they named the young prince George. Sure enough, the Swedish paper Expressen, and I'm certain other papers and news outlets in the world, commented on how George was such a good name as he would follow in the steps of many other kings of that name. Expressen even pointed out, erroneously, that young Prince George would eventually become King George VII. What astounding ignorance on the part of the media, the very people who have taken on the task of keeping the masses informed. It is indeed highly unlikely that Prince George will ever become King George VII. If anything, he'll likely be King George IX if his father William also takes the name George upon coronation. Then again, Prince George may well want to take yet another name upon his coronation. He may become King Henry IX, for all we know. Now, what does all this have to do with seasons and the movement of the earth through space? Absolutely nothing, except to address another common misconception, which, like the one in that sci-fi flick, and the one considering the name of young Prince George, utterly distracts me and keeps me from enjoying the overall presentation. Many of you will know this song by Jerry Rafferty. Writes down the line. I really like this song as it has a very complex melody and chord progression, as well the lyrics are fairly clever, until you get to this part. You've been as constant as a northern star, the brightest light that shines. It's been you. You've been as constant as the northern star, the brightest light that shines. Now, in fairness to the late Mr. Rafferty, he is by far not the only one to harbor that misconception. Perhaps you do as well, or have done. The North Star, Polaris, long used by seafarers to find true north and to navigate, is not the brightest star in the sky. In fact, it's not especially bright at all. It does not become immediately apparent to anyone looking northward, and it typically needs to be found relative to other constellations or asterisms. I'm afraid that the ancient mariners were not so lucky as to have the brightest star in the sky as a navigational aid. The brightest star in the sky is Sirius, which is located in the constellation of Canis Major, the Great Dog. It's actually a very useful star to find if you're interested in planetary astronomy. It's always difficult to convey what is necessarily very visual information over the radio, but I'll do my best. I'm assuming that you can easily find and recognize the constellation of Orion. It's very recognizable. Once you have found it, take a look at the three large stars close together in the middle of the constellation, which form the asterism commonly known as Orion's Belt. Now, extend a straight line from Orion's Belt leftward, if you're in the northern hemisphere, and out behind Orion's back, as it were, until you encounter the first bright star, indeed the brightest star. That is Sirius. And what makes finding Sirius so important is that it serves as a reference. You will indeed see much brighter objects in the sky, but anything brighter than Sirius will necessarily be a planet. And then, of course, there's the moon. Finding planets is not so difficult either. All the planets move approximately in the same plane in their orbits around the sun. Thus, in the night sky, they'll be very close to the ecliptic. Remember, the ecliptic runs through the constellations of the zodiac, so if you can learn to recognize the zodiacal constellations, the brightest objects within them will likely be planets. Typically, with the naked eye, there's no problem seeing Venus, Mars, and Jupiter. In fact, at the moment, Jupiter is located more or less in the crotch of Pollux in the constellation of Gemini. Saturn was known to the ancients as well and must therefore be visible with the naked eye, though I personally have never been able to make it out. Any modest set of binoculars, however, will be ample in finding it. The other planets, while also near the ecliptic, will require a proper telescope to be seen. Now, if you're more into navigation than you are into planetary astronomy, perhaps you would like to find Polaris, the North Star. Luckily, that is not too difficult, given the reference asterisms used to find it are very widely recognizable. I'm presuming, again, that you are familiar with the constellation Ursa Major, and in particular, the asterism within it known as the Plough, or the Big Dipper. Look at the Big Dipper, and you'll see a handle and a pan. Take the two stars farthest away from the handle. They form a line that is roughly perpendicular to the line formed by the handle. Essentially, I'm talking about the two stars farthest away from where the handle joins the pan. You follow? Now, follow the line formed by those two stars upward, up being the open side of the pan, and continue. Now, high up in the sky, there's another constellation called Cassiopeia, which is easily recognizable as it looks like the letter W. Now, look at the direction in which the three stars forming the tops of the strokes of the W are pointing. Go to the star in the middle of that W and then form a line extending from that middle outward in the direction of the top of where the W is pointing. Where that line intersects with the line you extended out from the Big Dipper, you'll find the North Star. You will furthermore notice that this North Star is at the very tail end of another asterism, the Little Dipper, which looks much like the Big Dipper, but only smaller, as the name implies. The North Star is at the very end of the handle. Not at all bright, is it?
figure strolling through the crowd like Pete DeLauro contemplating a crime. She comes out of the sun in a silk dress, running like a watercolor in the rain. Don't bother asking for explanation, she'll just tell you that she came in the air of the cat.
Thank you.
While classical Western zodiac is based on the 12 months of the year during which the sun travels through the various constellations, the Chinese zodiac is based on a cycle of 12 years, each year associated with some kind of animal. Apparently, the year of the cat actually corresponds to the year of the rabbit in the Chinese zodiac, but is known as the year of the cat in Vietnam. As I don't know more than that, and as this is an episode about disabusing people of misconceptions, I will not comment or speculate on that. I'm sure some listener out in Radio Land knows the reason, and I'd be interested in finding out. That said, the Chinese and space remind me of another popular misconception, namely that the Great Wall of China can be seen from the moon. Needless to say, this is certainly not true, though the myth lives on and can even be found in many forms of popular media. The source of this myth can be traced back to at least 1754, when William Stukeley, an academic traveler of renown in his time, commented on his encounter at the Great Wall. Impressed by such a monumental construction, he commented in a purely allegorical way that it would be possible to see the wall from the moon. In 1754, the distance between the Earth and Moon was known to man, and was a figure quite close to what we understand it to be today. As well, optics had been well understood, thanks to the work done in the century prior by Sir Isaac Newton. However, there's no reason to think that Stukeley was making a well-calculated scientific statement, but rather simply wanted to impress on people the grandeur of such a monumental undertaking as the Great Wall of China. And needless to say, he was not speaking anecdotally, as it would be more than two centuries before a man would walk on the moon and be able to offer a confirmation. Indeed, those men who have walked on the moon have on more than one occasion reported that they could not make out any sign of human constructions or activities when looking back at Earth. Now, you'll still hear claims that even if the Great Wall is not visible from the moon, that it's visible from space and that astronauts from low Earth orbit have seen it. This is untrue as well. The Great Wall of China is not visible from low Earth orbit either. It is far too narrow an object to be seen. You see, neither the actual size of an object nor the distance an observer is away from it on their own determine whether or not an observer can see it, but rather a combination of the two. What is vital is how great an angle of view the object fills from the observer's point of view. If you extend your arm as far as you can and hold up your index finger, that finger fills about 1 degree of view in front of you. It will differ from one person to the next, but as a rough guess, one finger extended at a distance of one arm's length away from your face will fill about 1 degree of view. That means that 360 fingers placed the same distance around you, each side by side, would complete an entire circle. You have no trouble seeing it. Now, bringing the finger closer to you, you see that it fills more and more of your field of view, and that it blocks more and more of your view of any object behind it. Now, if you're actually doing this exercise, it helps to do it with one eye closed. Now, a person with 20/20 vision can discern an object occupying a field of view as little as 1 arc second. That's 1/3600th of 1 degree. That is about the width of a printed full stop on a newspaper held at 10 feet. You might not be able to read the text that small from such a distance, but you can discern that text is there. Now, the Great Wall of China is no more than 30 feet wide at its widest points, and the moon is 240,000 miles away from the Earth. To see the wall from the moon would be equivalent to seeing the width of a single strand of human hair from 2 miles away. That would require a human being to have a clarity of sight more than 170,000 times greater than 20/20. Now, simply from low Earth orbit, much closer than the moon, the width of the Great Wall is still much less than 1 arc second. What furthermore makes it difficult is that the color of the wall does not contrast especially much with the surrounding environment. Plus, looking at the wall through all those miles of atmosphere will serve further to blur the sight. Thus, it really is not possible to see the Great Wall of China from space, let alone the moon. What makes this misconception even more inaccurate is the oft-touted claim that the Great Wall of China is the only man-made object visible from space. In fact, there are several objects, as well as other human activities, that can be seen from space, if not from the moon. Indeed, the Chinese inland canal system can be seen from low Earth orbit, and this was even at first mistaken for the Great Wall of China. City lights at nighttime shine very clearly and are seen by astronauts. One other thing that surprised the astronauts was the fact that they could see the wakes of ships and other ocean-going vessels, even if the ships themselves were not visible. This is easily explained in that the width of the wake of a large ship and the distance of a spacecraft in low Earth orbit from the Earth fills an angle of view greater than 1 arc second, and is therefore visible to the human eye. Now, from space, it's quite clear that the Earth is round. If there was any doubt in the past, then such doubt has been removed once and for all. However, that fact that the Earth is round has been understood for a very long time. Another popular misconception held, largely among children, but I've encountered adults who think so as well, is that Christopher Columbus was the man to discover that the world was round, and that he deliberately set out to sail to prove it. Of course, this is not true. The roundness of the Earth was not at all a controversial question in Columbus's time. While questions as to the correctness of either the heliocentric or geocentric worldview remained controversial long after Columbus's time. The roundness of the Earth, at least at a hypothetical level, was known in antiquity since at least the 6th century BC in ancient Greece, and by the 3rd century BC during the Hellenistic period, that's the period beginning with the rule of Alexander the Great and ending with the death of Cleopatra, the roundness of the Earth was taken for granted and evidence was widely observed, particularly by travelers. In particular, stars seen to be located near the pole to an observer in Crimea would disappear below the horizon when that traveler reached Egypt. Conversely, Aristotle observed that there were stars in the southern sky that could be seen in Egypt to Cyprus, which could not be seen further north, as they were down below the horizon and under the curvature of the Earth. The Greek Eratosthenes noticed that at Cyrene, a city in Egypt on the Tropic of Cancer, upon the summer solstice, the sun was directly overhead, while on that same date in Alexandria, further north, the sun cast a shadow. Using this observation, Eratosthenes was furthermore able to calculate the circumference of the Earth and got a figure that was amazingly close to the value that we understand today. Now, without circumnavigating the globe or traveling into space, there is ample and quite obvious evidence to the roundness of the Earth all around us, and it should not be surprising to anyone that the fact has occurred to civilized man for a very long time. It was very apparent, for instance, to sailors, even on short voyages, in that they got a better and more distant view by climbing on top of the masts, allowing them to see down and under the horizon. And when approaching shorelines, the tops of mountains became visible first, and then more and more of the mountains seemed to rise up into view as the ship approached closer. I noticed a similar phenomenon in Reykjavik when I lived there years ago. Standing at the shore and looking northward across the bay, you can see a large alpine glacier on the other side. From Reykjavik, it looks like the glacier covers the entire mountain. However, once you cross the bay, you see that the glacier is only the top of an immensely larger mountain. From Reykjavik, the lower part of the mountain is concealed under the curvature of the Earth. These are just some of the clues that would suggest to a curious mind that the world is round, and we need to give the generations that live before us the benefit of the doubt that just because they did not have DVD players and microwave ovens, that they were not simple people, and likely not oblivious to the obvious. That the fact that we cannot definitely credit any one man with the discovery of the roundness of the Earth only serves to prove just how long ago that fact was discovered. As for Christopher Columbus, he was a first-rate mind and a man of profound courage and dedication. We do his memory a disservice, in fact, by crediting him falsely with something that is rather unspectacular and then never learning anything about the man's real achievements. Listening to VSI Radio International. I invite you to get in touch and offer any comments or questions you may have. To contact the program, please send an email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. VSI Radio International is produced in Sweden, exclusively for broadcast on WBCQ, transmitting out of Monticello, Maine, USA on 7,490 kilohertz. My name is Paul Lambert. I should make it clear that I don't blame people for harboring misconceptions as such. I've personally had misconceptions in the past, and probably still do. There are some matters that I quite simply have not considered as much as others. For instance, I know virtually nothing about medicine and probably have the wrong idea about a lot of things and harbor many misconceptions relative to what is known to medical science today. That's just one broad example. Of course, I cannot tell you what misconceptions I hold until they're pointed out to be misconceptions, at which point I no longer hold them. However, sometimes I get bothered with people who harbor such misconceptions that demonstrate a tremendous lack of thinking or reflection on their part. Nowhere do I see such misunderstanding and lack of reflection as I do in questions of chance and probability. On far more than one occasion, far more, I've met an expectant mother who will say things like, "Well, this will be my second baby. The first one was a girl, so chances are that this one will be a boy." What? No, they're not. The chances are 50-50, just like last time. When I first heard this sort of statement, I thought the particular woman involved just made a mistake and did not think before she spoke. However, there are lots of people who would make this same mistake, and in general, who do not understand probability as a concept. There's an entire branch of mathematics behind probability, but what it deals with is uncertain events. Its calculations and evaluations only apply as long as the outcomes are unknown. As soon as you have a known, then the previous calculations are all out of whack and need to be redone. The chances of an event that has occurred, of occurring, is always 100%. So take the case of the mother-to-be. Given that she will, in the future, have two children, the odds of them both being girls is indeed 1 in 4. There'll be a 1 in 2 chance in the first case, multiplied by a 1 in 2 chance in the second case, 1 in 4. However, once the first baby is born and turns out to be a girl, that does not then leave a 3 in 4 chance of the second one being a boy. Having already had a girl, the chances of the next one being a girl is 1 in 2, just the same odds as having a boy. The birth of each child was an independent event. Once both children are born, what were the chances of them being the sexes they were? 100%. Probability only deals with uncertain outcomes. Once an event has occurred, no matter how unlikely it was to occur before it happened, the chances were always 100%. I know this seems rather counterintuitive, but it should be clear upon explanation. Still, it's shocking how many people still don't get it, even when explained thoroughly. So, say you meet a woman who tells you she had 5 children, all of them girls, and then asks, "Well, what were the chances?" Well, the chances were 100% after the fact. And before giving birth to any particular baby, the chances were 50-50 in each case. Having had 4 girls did not in itself make it any more or less likely that the 5th would also be a girl. There is actually a rather famous and even controversial mathematical problem concerning probability that stemmed out of the old TV game show Let's Make a Deal, which I'm just barely old enough to remember, hosted by Monty Hall. A contestant was asked to pick a door to open. There were 3 doors. Behind one of the doors was a great prize, like a new car. And behind the others was a goat, which in essence meant that you lost the contest. I don't know if anyone really took home a live goat. The contestant would pick a door, but before the door was open to reel the prize, or lack thereof, the host would first open one of the other doors that the contestant did not pick. And that other door was always necessarily one of the losing doors, thus leaving only 2 doors unopened. The contestant was then given the opportunity to switch doors, to change his mind and open the other unopened door instead. Now, what are the odds that the prize is behind the other door? Many people, in fact, many mathematicians, felt that there was no difference and the chances were 50-50. However, if you really wanted to play the odds, you would switch, always, and here's why. Remember that probability only deals with outcomes that are uncertain. The host has an enormous effect on the outcome in that he represents an element of certainty. He knows where the prize is and which door is correct. So in opening an unpicked door, before offering an opportunity to switch, he is necessarily going to open a door which he knows is a loser. Now, with three doors behind which only one has a prize, the chances of you picking the right door the first time is 1 in 3. This means there is a 2 in 3 chance that you picked the wrong door. So when Monty opens one of the losing doors to reveal one of the goats, the chances are still 2 in 3 that you picked the wrong door. Having most likely picked wrong, you're more likely to win if you switch. And since Monty has revealed one of the doors that you should not pick, you are always twice as likely to win by switching. Every time. I hope that made sense. A lot of people have a hard time with this one. Of course, widespread misconceptions concerning probability are what feed such things as casino gambling. Imagine a game of roulette. The chances of the ball coming down and landing on any particular number in a given play is 1 in 37. And each spin is an independent event. So say you watched the number 6 come up 4 times in a row. What were the odds? Right, having actually watched it happen, the odds were 100%. But say after watching 6 come up 3 times, you decide to place a bet on the 4th spin. What are the chances that 6 will come up again? 1 in 37, exactly the same as any other number, and exactly the same odds as in any other spin. This too might seem counterintuitive, but even if the number 6 came up 1,000 times in a row, assuming that no form of cheating is going on, that does not make the number 6 any more or less likely on the 1,001st spin. Many casino games and lottery tickets have features that give the player the false sense, the misconception, that he somehow has some control over the game, when in fact, no matter what he does, the outcome is still a product of random chance. Think of the lottery games in which numbers are drawn. Many such tickets will have pre-selected numbers when the player buys a ticket, but there are many as well in which the player gets to choose his own numbers. Aside from perhaps the fun of getting to pick the numbers yourself, or any emotional attachment you might have to such numbers, perhaps you pick your wife's birthday or your anniversary, choosing lottery numbers of your own serves absolutely no purpose. Say you're playing a game in which you pick 6 numbers between 1 and 50. Would you be inclined to pick the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6? Why not? That series is just as likely to win as any other 6 numbers drawn. If you find that counterintuitive, well, then perhaps you should look at it the other way. That is to say, knowing that any series of numbers you pick is no better than 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, it should sink in just how unlikely you are to win such games. While I don't play such games or buy such tickets myself, I do see people in the stores buying them and picking numbers. They show their friends their tickets, to which their friends will say things like, "Oh, those look like good numbers." What is it that makes them good numbers? People think numbers should be spread out, so not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, for instance, or that they should pick numbers, you know, one number from each row and stuff. All of that's nonsense. There's no way of knowing if they are good numbers until the drawing, and then they are only good if they correspond to the numbers drawn. And then, until then, no set of numbers, no matter how well spread out they are any better than 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Then you look at those people who play the same numbers every single week. They have their own numbers. There is an impression, which even roulette players and blackjack players and people who bet on horses have, that somehow eventually their numbers will be due. Having not won with those very numbers for so many weeks or even years, their numbers are supposedly due to be picked at any time, and they think that this is a serious strategy. Each individual lottery drawing or spin of the roulette wheel is an independent event. There is no reason why any number or series of numbers should be due. In fact, there's no reason to think that your own number will ever come up. Say one week the numbers that come up are 10, 13, 17, 34, 41, and 50. Would you be better off choosing those very numbers the next week or another set of numbers? Well, by now you know the answer. The chances are exactly the same. Yes. Given that a specific series of numbers were drawn 1 week, the odds of that very same series of numbers being drawn again the next week are exactly the same as any other given series of numbers. Does this seem counterintuitive as well? Well, then again, let it sink in just how unlikely you are to win such games. The new electronic video slot machines have new features, such as allowing you to choose which line of three to play as your slot, and you can even choose diagonal lines, all sorts of combinations. This all offers an illusion of the player having some control over the outcome. In fact, it is still all random. There is nothing you as a player can do to affect the outcome of a game of pure chance. Sure, some people win and win big, and you may notice that even in the largest casinos, when someone wins big, there are all sorts of bells and whistles sounding off and sirens and flashing lights. This is all psychological warfare. It reinforces in the minds of the hundreds of other punters who will walk out empty-handed that they could win, and that some people do win, and thus they are enticed to stay and feed more money into the machines. You may have seen films in which a casino will have weighted roulette tables or even complex electronic means by which to rip off players. Well, believe me, that's only make-believe. Casinos don't need to cheat. The very mathematics of the games played makes the house a winner every time. Even a perfectly honest game, the chances of a player winning any particular hand or spin are so low that the only way to win at gambling in the long run is to be on the other side of the table. Now, all that said, while I don't play myself, I'm not against lotteries or casino gambling. If you like and enjoy the games themselves and find them to be a lot of fun, then it's probably no worse than any other form of entertainment on which you're prepared to spend a lot of money. I only hope that those who do engage in these activities at least know what they're getting into, and that they can disabuse themselves of a lot of the misconceptions concerning chance and probability. Thank you for joining me this week on VSI Radio International. The program continues next Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern on WBCQ. Don't forget to tune into the station throughout the week for some more interesting programs here on Free Speech Radio.
If you've enjoyed this presentation, visit www.justrightmedia.org for more programming that's not right-wing, it's just right.